Hey, welcome to the Africa Podcast. My name is Mikey Mhenno. Today on the series, we have Professor Minna Ara on the series. She is a Nubian architect and researcher, and I'm really excited about having this conversation on the series. I hope you enjoy it. And as always, if you'd like to join the community, go over to africa.com/join to connect with other Africa members all over the world.
Welcome, everyone, to a live taping of the Africa Conversations podcast. My name is Mikey Mhenna. Today, we have Dr. Minna Ara, who is an architect and researcher who is an assistant professor at the Carleton University School of Architecture and Urbanism. Minna holds a PhD in architecture and a master's of arts in gender and design. She's a third-generation displaced Egyptian Nubian, which ushers her research interests in race, gender, space, and territory. Among her publications are Nubia Still Exists, The Utility of the Nostalgic Space, The Non-Work of the Unimportant, The Shadow Economy of Nubian Women in Displaced Villages and Liminal Publics, Marginal Resistance. Minna, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for this invitation. I'm really excited about this one.
So this is one of those questions. This is one of the conversations that for me sort of will help open up myself as Mikey to a whole host of questions, new questions. So I suspect that I will learn an enormous amount in the next hour, but I suspect I will realize how little I know. So I'm excited, tremendously excited to talk about this. Let me ask you about one thing. And it's something from your bio. And if you'll humor me, what does it mean to be a third generation displaced Egyptian Nubian?
Well, thank you for this question. Let me tell you another question that kind of gets me to that statement. My people were displaced in the 1960s. I was born in the late 80s. I started getting my education or doing research around this issue, around my people, there's displacement, what happened in the 2000s, maybe 2004, 2006. Yet, even though I have none of my dates have anything to do with the date of displacement, I was born years after. I've never seen anything but the displacement village, and I've never seen my ancestral land. I still identify as displaced. So I end up asking myself this question: what does it mean to be displaced from where you have never been? So how does it make sense for somebody to be displaced from somewhere that they have never been to? And then that comes to this recognition of displacement and its utility and this kind of strategic essentialism, as well as Spivak calls it, that you identify as displaced because you refuse to let the old land go, even though you have never seen it. You just keep reproducing this old land across generations. So my mother was displaced when she was two. When she goes near the old land, she starts tearing up. She doesn't really have a recollection of the old land. So her mother would be the person who got displaced with my mother on her arm. And then my mother would be the second generation, and I would be the third generation. I remain displaced, even though I have never been really to the old land. So yeah, That's how a third generation displaced comes from. Because we are, Nubians are a series of generations of people who remain displaced from somewhere they have never seen before.
Yeah. It's interesting. So one of the titles of the publication that you described is Nubia Still Exists, The Utility of the Nostalgic Space. So before I get into that piece, which I really want to talk about, I want to talk about where that land is. I have a map on this the screen of a Google Map satellite image of where the Aswan Low and High Dam is. So if you can just give us some sort of big pictures, when you say Nubia still exists, you know, where is Nubia? And I know that's a complicated question to answer, but it would be useful to sort of
Simple. I can tell you it's very simple. On a map, Nubian land is the land that starts somewhere from the first cataract in Aswan, so somewhere around the south of Aswan City, down the way to the, you count 5 cataracts of the Nile Valley. It's supposed to be the 5th cataract, not the 6th cataract, but you go all the way to the Dongola city in Sudan, and that's the stretch of Nubian land. This is the historical stretch of Nubian land. So Nubia is a real land. It's a real place that exists between that stretch of the Nile Valley. It's a Nile Valley culture that has lived there for millennia. So when you go to Aswan, they're going to tell you, let's go to Nubia, and they're going to take you to one village. That's not true. Our land was this long stretch of land with 5 sections, 5 municipal sections with 5 different dialects and long history of commerce and culture and so many things, just like all other people on Earth.
Yeah. That's really, really helpful context. And I'll put an image on the screen that sort of is even more zoomed out that might be more familiar to people who are not familiar with that part of the Nile. So you can sort of see globally where that is. But I want to talk about the term nostalgia. So that paper that we're talking about, Nubia Still Exists on the Utility of the Nostalgic Space. I'm going to read a quote from that thing. And then I kind of want you to sort of unpack this idea of nostalgia. So this is from that piece. You say in that piece, as the Nubian land was submerged in the materiality due to the building of the Aswan High Dam in the 1960s, the term Nubia now is defined through a nostalgic apparatus. Nevertheless, the term has come to mean different things, as different nostalgic apparatuses have stemmed from different political interests. To post-displacement Nubians, nostalgia is the mechanism of creating a virtual space of Nubian agency. In displacement, Nubians have evoked a nostalgic meta-narrative of the lost paradise to create a common space. This meta-narrative has been acting as the ground foundation for common space, and this common space has been populated and modeled using stories and images of our land, of our old land. What I want to ask you is, yeah. Go ahead, sorry. You were going to say
go
something.
Go ahead with the question. No, I'm just reacting. Yeah, thank you. It's like, oh, I wrote this. Sure. Okay, go ahead.
You're like, that's good. I agree with this person. No, I guess I wanted to ask you, I'm always curious when academics and sort of scholars write about deeply personal topics. Is this something that you are sort of like discovering inside of yourself at the same time? Like if I had spoken to Minna 10 years before writing this, would she have agreed with the sentence, this idea of the meta-narrative and how nostalgia is really at play?
Well, how nostalgia is really at play is something that I would agree with now and before. I have to say, this is the idea of the remembrance and this nostalgic apparatus, as I call it now. Well, now I'm using all these analysis tools that are academically induced, if I might say, but the fact that we are nostalgic to a land that we have never seen is true in effect. We keep imagining it in our collective consciousness, and it's always fueled by our grandmothers telling us the displacement village is not really our land. Our land was heaven on earth. We had this beautiful space by the river. We had, everything was perfect, which is actually might not be true. It was a normal human settlement in which things happened. I'm sure there was conflict. I'm sure there were precarities, the economic precarities, especially during a 20th century where the British were sucking the blood out of this entire region, taking all the all its crops and all its wealth away from it. But there is this notion of the fact that it was ours. We got to decide it. We got to territorialize it. We got to make it that makes it heaven on earth, because we get to decide what it is. And there is another, this notion of the fact that this maybe is a place for design. This is not about how the land was as much as how do we want it to be when we take it back. Because as just like our brothers and sisters who are indigenous to many different parts of this world, Land Back project is a central project in the Nubian consciousness. So the nostalgic apparatus becomes this fuel, this emotional work that we're all doing, remembering the old land, looking at pictures, trying to find names and find our old houses. The first thing I did when I was starting this thesis is find the map on which my ancestral land was. And the first thing I was looking for is my grandmother's house. Where was my grandmother's house in that old map? It's somehow me having a place and placement for something I feel like I own, because it's so important to make this real. It's just emotional work that we're all trained to do as Nubians in our engagement to our old land.
You're quite literally trying to ground your story.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to fill in some of the gaps because I'm sure some people who are listening are saying, okay, you know, like displacement, at least me as somebody who grew up in Beirut, when I think of displacement, I think of the Nakba, right? I think of the story of many, many Palestinians in my life. And I admittedly was unfamiliar with what that point was in the story of the displacement of many Nubians. So let's fill in some of the gaps. How and why were so many Nubians displaced?
Okay, let me tell you the story and how I heard it from my foremothers. You can look and find the story of Nubian displacement. If you don't know it, that's probably intentional. Projects of displacements are always followed with projects of invisibilization and making it not anybody else's business, so that it's contained within nation state projects as we all know it. And if you are anywhere in the Arab world, there are projects of displacement and disposition around you probably have never heard of. It's probably next door, but you don't know about it because it has been invisibilized. It's part of the project. But Nubians were displaced in the 1960s because Abdel Nasser needed a new pyramid. He needed this big national project that kind of encompasses Egypt, a new identity, the modern, the industrial, going into a new age, electricity, the high dam, through which he displaced almost every single Nubian within the Egyptian borders, because Nubian land, just like other indigenous land around the world, in Europe, our brothers and sisters, the Kurd, in indigenous people on Turtle Island, our land was sliced between two nation states, between Egypt and Sudan. So within the Egyptian borders, he submerged almost every single Nubian settlement, historical ancestral settlement in the Egyptian border, and quite a few in the Sudanese border. And we're talking about cousins here. So these are our blood relations, because we didn't really see a border. It was just a 3-hour boat between Adenden and Halfa. And people would just go from one place to visit their cousins, to visit their in-laws, to visit their families. So there were all these kinships in Nubian land. We never really saw the border before the border was enacted and the displacement happened to move all Nubians way to the north and the Sudanese who were displaced way to the south and create that gap between Nubian people. So
Minna, I want to stop you for a second. I just want to be clear about this. When you say submerged, you literally mean submerged in water.
Yes. So when you build a dam, what dams do is that they block water on a river, on a water body. They block water so that you can control its movement and its intensity, store it, and generate electricity. So for you to store that, you need the river to become a lake. The water is going to sit behind it. And that with that, you mean you're going to inundate an entire peoplehood. You're going to inundate an entire culture behind it. And in Egypt, I think we have 300 kilometers of Nile Valley inundated with the Lake Nasser, with the High Dam Lake. So every dam has a reservoir. The structures of dams are basically a big structure of concrete, stone, or whatever higher, and you just put it on the water, on the body of water, and as it moves, you block its movement so that you can control its movement. And with that control behind that body of water, you build a big lake to store water and to create the pressure needed to generate electricity. And for that project, Abdel Nasser had to inundate all Nubian villages within the Egyptian border and a couple within the Sudanese border.
Yes, so, and the location was obviously studied and was a political choice. This is the optimal place.
Well,
in his mind, obviously.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, there are so many discussions about this. I do not want to go into revisionist history. Was this the best place or not? Who cares? Why were those people rendered displaceable? Why is sacrifice? Why is sacrifice needed? Because also it comes with this military mentality about sacrifice and giving up yourself for the nation. And so why is sacrifice, why is human sacrifice needed for development? Which has been the process of modernity altogether, that it was always human sacrifice. So within this case, for the modern project in Egypt, we were the human sacrifice of that.
Yeah, of course.
Era. However, the story of displacement does not start in the 1960s with the high dam eating up all our land in Egypt. People usually start story of Nubian displacement then. What happened is that in 1902, the British built a smaller dam we call the Low Dam or the Aswan Dam. There was a smaller dam that started they built it in 1902. It started inundating agricultural land, which had decapitated Nubian economy. They raised the dam again in 1912, submerging more agricultural land. So when you submerge agricultural land, people cannot farm. They can't live. What happened is that a big flow of Nubians, especially Nubian men, no, particularly Nubian men, had to leave these villages and go and form a new class of serf in big cities in Egypt, Alexandria and Cairo. And you have all this trope of the Nubian servant, the Nubian doorman, the Nubian cook that had been prevalent during the 1920s, 1930s cinema. So you have already layers and slices of displacement that were caused by hydropower or by dams, all the way until the 60s, until the 60s came with the big dam that just uprooted everybody out of their place. The low dam even was heightened in 1933 to submerge villages. People actually died in their sleep because water went into their houses with horror stories that nobody hears about. I am reading my grandfather's memoir that he wrote listening to his grandmother, so my grandfather listening to his grandmother about what happened during the 1933 displacement, or the 1933 flooding, and it's a horror story. So this peoplehood have been going through layers of ruptures and layers of disposition all across the 20th century until the 1960s came in. But you also remember that when the state came in, they did all the cool stuff like participation. Let's ask the Nubian community what they want. And what they basically did is create fake models about the villages that they're going to build for Nubians, telling them, well, forget this old land. It's depleted. You don't have land. This men are already all over. It's only women in this land now. How about we go to this modern place where everything is going to be available for you? We're going to have schools, hospitals, everything. And told Nubians that this is the promised land, which is the displacement villages where I was born. Still, most of Nubians did not want to be displaced from their ancestral land, but they had to. It was a forced displacement. It's not that they had any choice in it. What I'm trying to say is that displacement came at the heel of several layers of displacement that happened on this land yet it was still forced. People still did not want to leave this land.
Yeah. I want to ask you two questions before we start talking about some of the economics of it. The first is there a moment after which there is no more displacement and khalas, like it's done? They have taken full control and the displacement project is essentially very sadly completed. That's the first question. The second question is, were there folks who ended up going south rather than north?
Well, you can't if you're an Egyptian citizen. The thing is, the state controlled this. The state brought in boats. They loaded Nubians in boats, then moved them to the shore and loaded them in buses and took them to their villages and said, well, this is your site of displacement. This is your new home. These villages were nothing like the models they saw, by the way.
They're like refugee camps. They're essentially refugee camps.
But it was not built as a refugee camp. It was a housing project. And it was seen as this marvel of modernist design. They called it, and this is a quote, they called it a Nubian house with a socialist tinge, which is, this is kind of the core of what I study with how did the Nubian house get disseminated within displacement. The Nubian house was something completely different from what they offered, 100 meter square displacement, kind of basically condo unit for dwelling unit for people. So the displacement the displacement village was also, that was not really the promised land. Also, it wasn't finished. So here's what our elders tell us. For every five families, only one had a house. Some people had chalk on the floor saying, on the ground, saying, okay, your house is gonna be here. So where do we go now? Wow. So I keep imagining the resilience and the care that this community had to give to each other to be somewhere with this condition. Because you can think a war can like people can kill each other because who the strongest is gonna get the house? Because there are the resources are dire, and when resources are dire, this is what people do. They start fighting over resources. But this community came together, carried each other, until they built the displacement villages kept in a building process in the building process between the 1960s when they started up until the late 70s. The building was continuing because it was not finished. In addition to the fact that the state then, so Abdel Nasser had this, so the displacement project was bigger than the fact that just let's move these Nubians there.
This is hundreds of thousands of people.
That's hundreds of thousands of people. Well, they undercounted Nubians, of course. So you can find different counts. So the state says there are 50,000 Nubians. Other scholars count 113,000 Nubians. Some other scholars count more. Some scholars, like Ali Amsalem, for example, looks at the history of demographics and the growth of population in Egypt and sees that these numbers are way under the count that was there in 1904, the demographics, the demographic counts that had happened. In addition to the fact that Nubians who were diasporic at that time, who left to work elsewhere, were not counted. So if you had to leave your land to work for somebody in Cairo and come over holidays, you would not be counted for as a person who lives there. So there were all these layers of undercounting, which of course we expect in these processes. So the displacement was just a mess. It was during displacement, the death rate among Nubians increased to be a quarter. So a quarter every year, a quarter of the Nubian population would die. And this I found as a casual statistic in Hussein Fahim's book, who was the Egyptian anthropologist who's studying that. At that time, I'm thinking, nobody stood there to think that a quarter of a population is dying and think that this is a big deal, that you're losing 23 and something percent of your of Nubian people in the during the displacement time. So the event of displacement was so much precarity, so much pain that hearing about it from Nubian women who were kind of who had to bear a lot of the brunt because the state had put all its resources in agricultural land. And this takes me to this whole Abdel Nasser's imagination. So I think, or I posit, that the Nubians moving north and not south, and there are evidence oral histories that says that they were asked if they wanted to go south. And they said, of course we want to go south, especially for Fadija people, because these are our cousins in the south. That's like, that's my in-laws in Halfa. But Abdel Nasser wanted to have this displacement village as a new development, and the propaganda material calls it the green factories. So he wanted Nubia to be this new breadbasket for Egypt. He wants Nubians to come from that land by the river, go to that displacement village, live the modernist life, and farm and produce food for the rest of Egypt.
Labor. So, he wanted the labor.
Exactly. And within the design of that village, I'm positing that it was not just about designing a new Nubia, because they called the displacement villages New Nubia. It was the design of the new Nubian, a Nubian they can use, a Nubian that works for the new nation state that they had imagined. So within that process, the focus was on the industrialized agriculture that they thought about. And the Nubian house and women's spaces were completely underfunded and were completely ignored. By that, I mean there was no water available to them. Women had to go get water from the agriculture facilities and had to go through a lot of layers of filtration. So I'm just trying to paint an image of how this imagination of trying to create a new person that works for a certain project has created so much pain and precarity, is especially in the first years, the first decade of displacement. I would say mid-60s to mid-70s were just a lot of pain for Nubians and a lot of loss and a lot of death.
Because there's like a simultaneous, it's like there's two counteracting imaginations that are happening, that are trying to define Nubia, right? There is the imagination of the displaced that are like clinging on to this place that they no longer have, right? And are in which it only exists in their imagination. And then there's the imagination of the state that's saying, no, we are reimagining who you guys are. You guys are these brand new Nubians, right?
You're modern. Yes. You're going to vote. You're going to be part of the modernism was the motto of this project. It was such a driver for what they thought it is. And some Nubians thought, well, this might be good. Some actually said, well, it might be good in the new land. But the amount of work it took for them to just settle and not die and not keep losing loved ones was immense.
Yeah, so there's this term in that I saw in one of your papers, development-induced displacement and development. Is that what you're talking about, DIDR? Is that this precise thing, or is that something else?
It's development-induced displacement and resettlement. DIDR. This is a term of art. So this is what is used in dam and development studies or development displacement studies. And this is something that it's an international term. So you'll find that people and countries accept the displacement of certain populations, usually poor and indigenous populations, for what they see as development. So there are DIDR projects for mining. There are a lot of DIDR for dams, because dams always eat up land. So dams are always going to eat up land.
Does this include like building highways through entire poor neighborhoods and saying, all right, highways. See you guys later?
Yeah. Highways. So there is always a sacrificial land. Who is a sacrificial place here? Who deserves to be sacrificed? And this comes to this question of displaceability. Who deserves to be displaced? What are the mechanisms that create certain peoplehoods displaceable?
Yeah. So I'm curious about the emotional imagination of Egyptians now, especially given more and more research on this topic and more, publications on this topic. Do you feel like there is a broader conversation about this period of time now as, I feel like we're entering into another new version of Egypt. Do you think there's a broader conversation about this or not so much?
No. So Nubians have always been steering the conversation. We have not shut up. There is always a wave of return. There is always a group fighting to take land back or for Nubian rights. As far as I have lived, there were always elders. There were always Nubian intellectuals. There were always Nubian human rights fighters who were trying to instate Nubian rights or argue for Nubian rights within the Egyptian political ecosystem. Yeah. However, there are other tensions at play. So there is the state that doesn't want the headache. Well, you are displaced, you're in the new village. The new village has so many problems, by the way. The new village has so many infrastructural problems, so many land quality problems, so many, it's just another budget trying to sustain the houses that keep cracking in the displacement village every 7 years or 5 years. It's a whole different animal, but still Nubians want to go back to their land. So the state wants to avoid the headache. And with the new state, they definitely want to avoid the headache. So Nubians are going to be incarcerated if they let's just say that it's much harder now to be Nubian or to speak and fight than it was 5-10 years ago. Well, as it was 10-12 years ago or before that. So it's the military regime is kind of focused on creating a certain image of Egypt, and no other narratives are going to be included in that. No, on the other hand, there is the public sentiment around Nubians. And you would find that Egyptians, there are different layers of history that inform this. There are layers of history that comes from the turn of the century, the Nubian servant, the Nubian lower class, that has been already substituting for the Nubian slave that was extracted and kidnapped from the south, not from our land or from our neighbors to the south, the Nuba people in the Kordofan area, and sold or enslaved to the north. Over 800 years of enslavement from the south to the north. Through the Bakht Treaty between the Arabs and the Nubians at the 800 years before that. But the British had outlawed slave trade, and it was not illegal to own slaves anymore. So the Nubian slave trade is no longer an option. And this was at the end of the 19th century. So by the beginning of the 20th century, this Nubian serf class, as I was saying, just came in and substituted. And the racialization and skin color, had to have a play in this. So there's that kind of imaginary, but there are also more layers, as in the happy Nubian, the singing Nubian, the cultural, the notions like the extraction of black joy, as you see it with our brothers and sisters who are descendants of enslaved people in on Turtle Island, for example. This kind of the Nubians and their culture and their pentatonic scale and their dance and their joy and their colors, the sensationalization of Nubia that is also extracted and commodified, but within Egyptian cities or within the Egyptian consciousness. So you find people saying, oh, we love Nubians. And by that they mean we get so entertained by them, but also it's a culture that we own. So there is this level of ownership by the central or mainstream Egyptian culture over Nubian culture, which is the central cultures or center cultures have done that with so many cultures in many nation states, right? So the what they call minor cultures that probably range to other areas and other connections and other relationalities become claimed by the center. This is Egyptian. And I blame archaeologists for that. I just want to say this. Because Egyptologists specifically. So the Egyptologists are basically, so I would ask my Egyptologist, I always ask my Egyptologist friends, go to your papers and tell me that you have never cited a white supremacist. All the heads of this field that started where these white supremacists who come from that understanding that ancient Egyptians were white, that's why they produced all these amazing things. Well, the black people to the south were basically a subaltern and minor culture that's a serving culture or subdued culture to that major whiteness. Because to them, Nubians were black. Egyptians had some kind of whiteness in them. That's why they have a lighter skin. That's when the construction of race started with the colonial, this colonial proposition. That, well, listen, all of you in the north, you probably have white blood. That's why you were great and you have a history. But then you start at Nubian and you're black people.
Yeah.
So there is this kind of ownership that what everything you find in Nubia is Egyptian too, because Egyptian history owns Nubia. So you have this this kind of ownership or claim over your history by a central narrative that was also constructed. Because all these the idea of the ancient Egypt was constructed, whether by the English trying to find to make this, or the British, or all these Europeans coming in trying to see how great white people did on the African continent, the ancient Egyptians, or by Abdel Nasser kind of changing the history. So the history of ancient Egypt is divided into these dynasties. When we studied it in the history book, it did not say dynasties; it said states. So it's not about the first kingdom, second kingdom, late kingdom, middle kingdom. It's about the early state, the middle state, and the late state. So for Abdel Nasser, the ancient Egyptian history is a state history, so that he can join his project to this, or think about his project as a continuation of that lineage. So you have the national imaginaries or larger imaginaries trying to fit Nubia in what they want it to be, including just the normal culture, which is now the happy, dancy, colorful Nubian, which is in itself a form of cultural serfdom. Use the how happy sure. And I love the colors, and well, dear, we have been displaced for 60 years. We are full of sorrow, pain, and hurt. So sure, you want us to dance? Sure. So yeah, you have this. So the discussion about Nubia is very complicated. I'm not saying that we have a lot of allies on the Egyptian left. For example, we have a lot of people who are informed and they read and they know the pain and they know what people have gone through on the other side, because we are not really let into the academic system. You can go and find 100 theses by master students who went on winter vacation for 5 days and came back and wrote a thesis about Nubia. And I read those, like, is there anybody to check on this? Like, is there anybody to tell these people that this is BS? So you have this weird relationship of extraction and subjugation and subaltern kind of identity.
Let me ask you, so
Nubians,
if you were to give me, Mikey, advice on stuff to read, right? And what do you think, what are some of the things that you would say off the top of your head? You're like, this is a really good resource. This will shed light on you if you're curious to learn more. What are some great resources to read or to check out for somebody like me, you know?
So for somebody, so there's the amazing work of the late Gustul Neita from our village of Gustul. Our uncle and our elder, may he rest in power, Muhyiddin Hassan Saleh. So he had published a bunch of books in English, in Arabic, with photo books about the history of displacement. And he wrote this amazing book on our village, Gustul. Well, it's a very localized book, but however, it also narrates the history of displacement and return. Because people of Gustul tried to return in the 1970s to the old land. So I would advise that people to try to read Nubians. We have not let... we were not led to write our own history. They always have been speaking about us, and we were not allowed to speak for ourselves for so long. The publishing industry was not letting Nubians in for so long. The hardships of displacement were not letting us to have the place to breathe and find a way to communicate our writings. But lately, there are a bunch of Nubian publications coming out, novels, cool. read Nubian stories, read the Shamandura, read Dongola, read Inubi by, well, we have, I would say, if you start with novels, Novel, because storytelling is such a central form of resistance for Nubians, and the story is going to touch you on that level.
Amazing.
I would say that, yes.
Can I ask you a little bit about my econ, and my econ side sort of gets really excited when I was reading about one of your papers about the role of specifically Nubian women in the economy. There's this phrase that I have on the screen for those listening to the podcast, where you said the Nubian shadow economy is an economy of care. And I was so taken by that phrase. I'm so curious if you could shed some light on what you think that means.
Well, there is this question that I was also thinking about, the economic question, the question of money, the question of resources, and how did it look like in the early years of displacement? So because I grew up in a house with all these Nubian women, my perspective and the story of displacement comes to me from Nubian women. However, if you ask any of them if they work, they're going to say no. They will be sorting crops. They will be doing something that you clearly identify as work. And they would say this is not work, because
sweat dripping from their brow.
Yes, it's this recognition that it's that professionalism paradigm defining what wage producing work looks like, and they don't consider what they're doing as work, and that's a devaluation. That's not a good thing. But the thing is that, well, this work that they have been doing, and sometimes adding so much value, money and other kinds of value to their households, and during the years around displacement and to this day, has been invisibilized. And they don't even call it work. This is why the paper is titled "The Non-Work of the Unimportant." It's okay. We're just doing this because this is our role. This is the care of labor we should be doing to take care of our families. We should take care of our households, to take care of our people. But when you look closely to this kind of work, you'll find sophisticated forms of financialization. Sophisticated forms of financing. Sophisticated forms of financing that rely on trust. Trust is something you cultivate emotionally. So you find forms of work that rely on extended care. The fact that the village now has been cut into pieces. The person that was living next to you in the old village is elsewhere now. And the village that was next to you in the old village that you walked to is now kilometers away, and you have to take a car to visit them. So that you have this new relationalities that had to be economically supported. So you have to produce new forms of trust. You have to produce new forms of relationalities. And you have to support that financially, because you need a lot of money to build the damn village that was not even completed. So you had these things be formulated. You had these elder women being custodians of money and microfinancing projects to build houses and to build extension to houses. And you're not thinking of these as, people don't think of these as workers. This is your in-house bankier. But you're not thinking of this as work, because you think this is just your role. This is the care that you have to do. And the word work, that is in Arabic, we have to also recognize the rift and the difference in languages. These women spoke Nubian, they did not speak Arabic. And the word work that comes from Arabic has its own structure. So when the structure and the system recognize this as work, we can call it work. But because the system doesn't recognize it as work, this is what we are just doing, what we need to do to live. So it becomes this economy of care that becomes invisibilized by the system within all these linguistic and within these political recognitions of work. What it counts as work? Because what counts as work is what gets compensated as work. Is all this work becomes uncompensated.
Yeah. We are running out of time, so I want to ask you a final question before we do the quick Q&A, which is, what are you working on now?
Okay, what I'm working on now. So I'm continuing the reading of my grandfather's memoir, his book. I found the manuscript and it was never published in my grandmother's house. So this is what I'm reading now, trying to kind of write it and get it out. I'm working on building. So I've always look myself as a person who studies Nubian women building and tries to build like a Nubian woman. So right, the study of it. And then the study of it is, I study it because I want to practice it as an architectural practitioner. Amazing. So I am working with community partners all over the city of Ottawa, where I live, on finding architectural services and adding architectural services to people who probably look like us, who have been displaced by projects of gentrification and financialization and the monster that we have now in architecture, which is development. So the two streams that I'm working on are always this kind of trying to study Nubian women, how they built, how did it look like, what did it mean, and then try to build like a Nubian woman and how it meant, and hopefully have my grandmother be proud of me.
Amazing. Can I ask you one last question before we do the quick Q&A?
Sure.
You mentioned that there are estimates in the 1960s of how many Nubians were displaced, right? Anywhere between 50,000 on the very low end to, maybe upwards almost to 200,000, somewhere in that range, right? Today in 2022, do you have a sense of how many folks around the world describe themselves as being Nubian?
Nope. We cannot put numbers on it.
Yeah.
If you ask people like Aziz Osman, who is the editor-in-chief of the Sultan Nuba, the newspaper. Yeah. So he was, when I asked him a while ago, he said, well, the last estimate he heard was that there are 3 million Nubians around the world. You can't count Nubians because you can't convince a nation state, neither is Egypt or Sudan, to count Nubians. The only way we can count is when diasporic Nubians are centralized around clubs, so the club knows that there are 38,000 Nubians in Saudi Arabia, or there are that much in France, or that much in Europe, or so on. Yeah. But having a clear count is not feasible, but also it doesn't matter. And I'm always thinking, how many Nubians as to how much pain, but it doesn't matter. This justification of minoritization and thinking, well, there were not too many people, it does not matter. Nobody deserves to be subjugated, displaced, and dispossessed. Doesn't matter if the count was 50,000, 100,000, 200,000. It does not matter. Every group, large in count or not that large in count, deserves justice, deserves to identify its own territory, deserves to identify, to celebrate its own history, deserves to have a history. So even though we can't count, it would be useful for other economic reasons to know how many Nubians or how many people identify as Nubians. I would say it does not count. It does not matter. Mm. We don't deserve this anyways, doesn't matter. But also we have a new understanding of Nubians that we're trying to promote, which is who is a Nubian. And we think about Nubians as Nubians by lineage, but also we think of Nubians as Nubians by love. People who have lived among Nubians, who have positioned themselves in a Nubian culture, who live within it, who celebrate it, who study it, who dedicate their life to study it. Yeah. And we identify them as Nubians by love as well, to also subvert or disconnect from these rigid politics of identity. Who gets to be Nubian, who doesn't?
In the words, in the Afrika terminology, Nubian based off interest, not on identity. Do you have a stake? Not do you have a passport?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do a quick Q&A. And then if there are questions in the chat, somebody can type them in. So really quickly, what are you reading or watching right now?
Okay. What am I reading now? And I'm very late reading this. I'm reading The Red Deal by the Red Nation. This is a book for history. I'm very late. This was, I think, came out last year or 2 years ago. This is an amazing project, a big project by the Red Nation, our brothers and sisters, indigenous to Turtle Island, who were thinking about the importance of decolonization and the urgency of decolonization. I think that one of their quotes is decolonization or extinction. The fact that indigenous stories, indigenous worldview were erased because the colonial system needs its worldview to dominate that world. And with that domination came this huge blight in our environments, on this earth. So this is an important book, and I advise everybody to get it, The Red Deal.
Okay. Who would you love to shadow for a day, past or present?
My great-grandmother, who in their stories about her would have been going for world domination, and the person who single-handedly made sure that everybody in her household had a house in a displacement village all these boss moves. She was not a pleasant woman. This is also something about Nubians. Like, oh, Nubian women, all these nice black women. She was strict. She made everybody work. So I'd like to be there, but not like to be a shadow. She wouldn't see me, because if she sees me, she's going to make me work. I just want to see the process. I want to see how did she produce all that labor. I can't. If I'm going to build a house, it's going to take me a year. How would she build a house in 6 weeks and not pay a penny for labor, because she has all these people from the village building with her?
It's a new idea of economy of care.
Yes. Well, she was feeding people. So I want to see I have seen my grandmothers, and I can trace the stories of the grandmothers, but their mother, who was this woman who rode a donkey through the village when women were not allowed to ride a donkey through the village. So she was also a rebel. So it's like thinking about in Saudi Arabia now, the women who ride a car or drive a car when they're not allowed to, and when they were not allowed to. So in that time, it was only men who would take donkeys across the villages, not women. And she would have her donkey and she would just go across in front of everybody. So all these stories about that woman, as severe as she was, I would like to go see it for myself without her seeing me. Because I saw her. She died when I was seven. She died when I was seven. So when I was seven, I saw her as a kid. I did not see her in action, and I would like to see her in action.
Cool. I'm going to jump to the Q&A from the audience, because we have a question from the audience. I'm going to read it. It's from somebody named Livingston. This has been really insightful, Minna. Thank you. Could you briefly speak about some of the material losses of Nubian displacement, especially reading, culture, architecture, arts, language? And what are some of the ways in which Nubians are reinventing those traditions?
Well, the culture, the language is definitely one of the biggest victims of this process. Just like our brothers and sisters, indigenous to so many places around the world who lost language and culture and are losing their last indigenous or language speakers by years. And during COVID, we've seen the loss of a lot of people. Nubians had lost a lot of language speakers, whether it's new generations not speaking Nubian or old generations dying. But because the state made it so, a systemic issue that made it so, because you find that Nubian does not really grant you any social upward mobility. So there is no utility in putting so much time in learning Nubian. On the other side, there are no resources. So with the suppression of resources and the kind of devaluation or discounting the efficacy of learning Nubin, it became, the language became in a big danger, especially in Egypt. Our Sudanese cousins are doing much better job than us.
Very, very cool. Well, Minna, thanks so much. This was a hugely informative conversation. If anyone is interested in finding Minna's work, you can find her on social media at MENNAAGHA. Minna, I really appreciate you doing this talk and allowing me to ask you a bunch of these questions.
Thank you so much for this invitation. I'm so glad. I'm so happy to be speaking to an Arabic audience or people with interest in the Arab world. Nubians are part of this community. We are not Arabs, but we live amongst this community, and it's very important for me that people know that we exist.
Absolutely. Okay, everyone, today's Friday. There's the last episode of the week. Next week, we have more episodes coming, and I hope you have a good weekend. Bye, everyone.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you'd like to learn more about what we do, go to hafikata.com, where you can learn about our Zoom events, our live events in 30 different chapters around the world, our social media presence, and our podcasts and YouTube stuff. You should know that everything we do is all towards a mission of converting passive interest in the histories and cultures of the Arab world into an active intellectual curiosity. By listening to this, you're a part of that movement, so thank you for being here. If you'd like to support our work, go to hafikata.com/support and join the hundreds of people around the world who make this work possible. Thanks.